One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine, ten.
I wanted to ask you a few questions. I better start off with some things about politics. That's all right.
Don't take it as gospel.
Well, I was reading Harold Moss's book on Hartsfield. Mm-hmm. He says that in 1953, Helen Bullock spoke to you about what the mayor could do to retain black political support. Apparently, John Wesley Dobbs had threatened to take his forces out of the Allegheny Negro Voters League because of Hartsfield's unwillingness to hire black policemen, black firemen. Apparently, according to his book, you...
I remember that Mr. Walden, who was another very important figure in the development of Georgia political participation by Negroes, was the chairman of, well, he was a person whom I'd known all my life. He was an early Atlanta University graduate, was the first lawyer to practice in the courts of Georgia after he came back to the University of Michigan. Right. He was the chairman of the League Board. I came to work with the League in 1943. And in 1946, the League, not directly, but served as a secretariat for this, or what came to be known as the All Citizens Registration Committee. And we did this massive registration drive, which in those days, we were faced with the poll tax, with the white primary, with, you know, all the difficulties. And the essence of our effort at that time was to really do a systematic blocking of the areas where black residents lived. Mm-hmm. And we were fortunate. It was an effort in which all the churches and the organized political groups, the Voters League and so forth, and so, both Republican and Democrat, everybody, the fraternities. It's, in my knowledge, the most complete community organization job.
And this is after the...
This was in 46.
After
it was organized in 46. And we tripled the registration on the Fulton County books in a 6 week period. Mm-hmm. You know, they used to close the registration books out at the time they closed the tax books.
Right.
Because, anyway... Well, that gave great impetus, and the second thing that happened in that connection, there was a special election for Congress. And I thought, who was it? Ram Speck that died, resigned. Anyway, Helen Douglas Mankin offered. She had been in the House. I had not known her, except she had been a person who was interested in broadening the franchise. And so her definite appeal for black support, it came sort of as a, it made the ordinary voter see that it paid to register Caesar, because that was the first opportunity for them to go to the polls and vote. And the results of that participation resulted in Mankin's election.
And she actually said she was the first white politician to actually...
Well, the others had not been as overt. Now, Mr. Hartsfield was a very close friend of Mr. Walden's, and worked with the black leadership. And there was no, at least I never was aware of any question about his willingness to do what he thought was possible at a given time and place.
At what stage? 1946?
This was during the, from everything, my early knowledge began in 43 and 44. So that by, whether this was supposed to be about 1950?
It's 53, but...
Well, it would be in this same period.
Okay, I'm just curious. Are you saying that Hartsfield began to respond to black demands before there were black votes coming in his direction?
Well, before there was any, before it was... I think he, yes, I think I would say that, even though there were many obstacles to black participation. He was a person who demonstrated that he wished to do all that he could do in terms of increasing participation. And I don't remember I've read Marvin's book, but I didn't remember that that was, and I don't remember what advice I gave him, but I may have.
That was 53.
That was in 53. And if I may have been in a position to suggest groups, you know, that he could talk with effectively.
Okay. I think that was what he wrote to you.
Yeah.
Told him basically what he could say.
Right.
But my feeling about Hustard was that he didn't really respond to the black community until after 46, when the votes began, after the white primary was over, when there was a reason to respond to the black community. I mean, I don't get any sense that Hartsfield was a humanitarian. He was a politician.
He was an essentially a politician, but I don't think he, at least my appraisal of him, is a person who would wish to be for full opportunity, you know, but was practical enough to know the limits within which he had to operate. I may be giving him undue credit, but that was the way I always felt that
I'm curious also what sort of promises he made to the black community for their support, again, after 1946. I guess one of them was black police.
Well, the police issue had been an issue for a long time. And I don't remember the date when they first hired police. When do you?
It was 48.
About 48, and they hired them on a restricted basis. But even that was a big game, you know. And you know, I mean, it's an example of this bit by bit. But, yeah.
Did he make any promises at all to try and keep racists out of the city government?
Well, I don't think it would be done that directly. I think leadership, by and large, community leadership. I don't know whether that's true now or not, but it was true then. It was more concerned about basic intent to do what is possible and to help.
He listened to your problem.
And yes, he would listen and would wish to be helpful. Now, sometimes he could and sometimes he couldn't.
Yeah.
But
I guess when Dobbs began to try and increase voter registration, I guess he had in mind eventually influencing the politicians.
Well, Dobbs was a politician himself and was a part of the organized political group. He had organized the Voters League, which was essentially, well, it was not, as I remember, Dobbs was the head of the Republican Voters Organization. And then, and I may be not exactly clear on the year, but following the 46 efforts and the elections that occurred then, the nonpartisan Voters League, I think, came into it, which was really to unite the Democrat organization, which at that time was under Mr. Walden's leadership, and that was before blacks were recognized and welcomed in the Democratic Party, you know. But that was the statewide mechanism, what was known as the Association of Negro Democratic Clubs, and that was the vehicle to use the registered electorate to influence the Democratic Party, particularly.
In terms of Hartsfield, then, again, he seems to have been responding to black issues and black demands after the Atlantic Negro Voters League was organized. That seems to be the catalyst, you think?
You know, it's hard for me to put a time and date on.
Yeah, I'm just kind of curious about whether he saw a change of heart after 1946 or after 1948. At what point did he really begin to respond? Because he certainly didn't earlier. I don't see any indication of that.
Well, I would guess that's as good a point to place on it as any, when it was clearly in terms of his own political interest and the political interest of the city.
Right.
And of course, Hartsfield was, you know, had no life beyond the city, I mean, in the sense. So that was all in character. But if it had been a part of the electorate that, you know, couldn't do anything about it anyway, once it was possible, once he saw that they should be, and he may or may not have had any strong feelings about what should be. Mm-hmm. But suddenly he was a person who did what he could.
When he also saw the
Republicans
supposed to be
right.
together, I guess. I was curious also whether, as he began to reach out to the black community, whether that issue was used against him in his campaign.
I don't recall that it was.
I was also curious about the work you did with the opening up of the youth clothing pavilion, because I know you were very active in that also.
Well, that was a part that the League, when I was, when I first came to the League, and this has something to do with the, what I believe about the nature of community leadership, the League had an inactive board of directors. And one of the first things that I felt was necessary, and with great support of people like Forrest Washington, who at that time was dean of the school social work at Atlanta, and had been active in the Detroit Urban League. And he was a member of our board. But we were together to try to get a representative board, representative in terms of both a representative and a participating board. And so that's the kind of board organization that we had. And we used as sort of the quote slogan of the agency that we were engaged in preventive social work. Mm-hmm. That is, we would try to work on the social situations which preventive way as well as cure.
Yeah, exactly.
And the first big project we had was related to the inequality of public education facilities, and it was pretty much our staff philosophy that we always had one big project on the front of the stove and something else boiling. So we did a factual study on the school thing, mm-hmm. and organized the Citizens Committee for the Improvement of Public Education, heading at a bond issue which had already been announced. Is this repeating what you know already?
No, I really remember that, but one of the questions I had really was
I'm coming to the Spalding business about that. Well, after the school study was so, it was the efforts we organized the Citizens Committee on Public Education, heading toward demonstrating to the whole public the great inequalities within the Negro public school system.
This was a black group over there.
Mm-hmm.
This was a black group through the Urban League over there.
This was the League, that this Citizens Committee was a representative committee.
Okay. And any white senator?
Oh, yes. And we did the director, the person who headed the research happened to be a member of the faculty at Atlanta University. We had a research committee,
mm-hmm.
and the report itself was published. And then we organized, with Helen's help and my other people's help, a broad spread campaign of public education, lots of little leaflets, I mean, which set forth in an easy. I was fortunate enough to have a personal friend who was J. Walter Thompson in New York, and he was awfully interested in that and was very helpful in helping to get the design of these things that we... and we set a time limit on it. We said we would spend a year prior to the time this bond issue was going to be voted on, because the Board of Education had announced a $10 million issue out of which they proposed to spend $1 million on black schools. See, that was what got people after the war. And the victory was evident, because by the time this program of public education had gone on for a year or two, and then the Board of Education announced that they had completed their plans for the bond issue, they proposed a $9 million issue. And I think 7 of the 9 was devoted to black school improvement.
And that was because you just threatened not to vote for the bond?
Well, I mean, that was, we never threatened that, but because the public was more informed mm-hmm. about what was to be done or what should be done with the money.
Mm-hmm.
And following that bond issue, there were black schools built. Washington High School that had, was built to house about 1,200 and housed about 36.
That was back in the 1920s, though, right?
Oh, this was in the 40s. I don't remember the date the schools were open, but it had no substantial increase or improvement.
So in other words, educating the public was one of the things.
Was a way yes. of getting understanding of the social needs.
Okay.
And then following the schools thing, we were very much aware of the limitations in medical care for the non-indigent population. And secondly, for the absolute lack of continued training opportunities for black professionals.
Yes.
And that meant opening up grading for learning opportunities, see. And so then we did another basic study on the health and hospital care needs of the Negro population. And we didn't do as it was widely distributed and it was done with competent people on the research staff. And we didn't do as extensive what I call mass education as we had done with the school things, but still got the needs into the public domain.
Into the entire public.
Into the entire public.
Politicians became aware of this?
Well, the people who were responsible for health care did. The hospital authority and to some degree, I imagine, the Fulton County Health Department. The chairman of the hospital authority at that time was Mr. Spaulding. And he was very responsive and very helpful in helping to move the groups along that he worked with. And of course it involved a mixed group. There's a funny story about that. I don't think I've told many people, I don't know if it ought to be repeated, but Mr. Spaulding invited a group of people concerned with health care. They were chairman of the health commission, I think, and the hospital authority people, and president of the Atlanta University, and the president of Morehouse, and so on and so on. We had the meeting out at the Morehouse. Mr. Spaulding said he had written letters prior to this saying that this was an important matter which needed the whole community's attention. He wanted to know what their opinion was. And he brought the letters and the replies in this folder. He was telling the group about it. And he said, I sent this to, he was one of the candlers, and he started reading the letter. He said, yes, build the niggers a hospital. Build the niggers a hospital. And Mr. Spaulding was so embarrassed, he just flipped over to him. He said, and so-and-so said so-and-so. But shows the way in which the slow learning occurred.
Yeah, but my feeling is that most whites probably didn't care at all what was happening to the blacks. Why this sudden interest in building a hospital?
Well, they didn't know anything about the hospital needs. So the needs, they, I guess they didn't, I guess they both didn't know and didn't, and therefore didn't care. But, I mean, that's part of it, I think, people.
So why did they care all of a sudden? Both
well, I think if you can point to the needs, and that's what we did, the relation of the condition, the social conditions of any substantial segment of the population to the welfare of the whole, you get response.
Well, do you think it was a matter of self-interest, or whites afraid of disease spreading out of the black community?
Well, I don't think it was that statistic. They just never had bothered.
They
weren't affected. The white population had access to both public and private hospitals to meet the needs of all segments of it. They knew that Grady was there for the indigent. And, you know, so...
So the black population is so much out of mind.
That, I think, is pretty much the state of affairs.
Yeah,
not really incredible.
Well, I mean, given the history, it's not. But,
yeah. But that is the background. I don't think Atlanta is any different from... Well, I don't think it's really any different from any big urban center. Where there's a considerable... I think in some ways there was more over the years, and suddenly at this period there was more recognition among the political leadership of the needs of the black community than was true in a city like New York.
Well, that's probably true.
Of course, the difference might have been that New York started off, or the big northern urban center started off with a theory of equality,
mm-hmm.
you know. But as needs changed, I don't think there was that's my impression. There was not always the recognition that it was important to pick up the lag.
When did this happen? When was Spaulding Pavilion opened up?
I think Spaulding Pavilion opened in about 50, I can't remember.
in the 50s or so.
Yeah, it was in the 50s.
Do you think this concern about black health demands, needs, was at all related to growing black wood guitar?
Oh, I don't know what it was.
It just seems incredible to me as we go through the 20s, the 30s, the 40s that nobody thinks about the black population at all. And all of a sudden, when political power comes along, there's certainly an awakening.
Well, you ought to read a study that was done of the state of Georgia in 19... I guess this was done in the early 40s. I don't even remember who paid for it, but there were two people, Janie Mackey, who was once a congressman, and Calvin Keitel, who was a newspaper person. Anyway, the group that sponsored the study, and it may have had some connection with the Southern Region Council, which is one of the early groups that you know about. But they went into every county to talk to me and to really get the picture of how political decisions were made. Mm-hmm. And the one published part of that study was an article that appeared in Harper's called A Long Dark Night in Georgia, and just showed and so Atlanta was no different from, in fact it was ahead, I guess, because, but it had to overcome the same areas of ignorance.
Yeah, that's for sure. Was there any opposition to building schooling or to integrating Grady?
Well, it was step by step. The way the integration of Grady's staff occurred, Spaulding became the way into the... You see, in a way, that was the hidden agenda. Access. Out in front agenda was the need for hospital facilities serving the non-indigent population of Atlanta. And that's when the hospital authority brought in a very able surgeon who's Dr. Yancey.
Oh, yeah.
As when he came to Atlanta, he was the medical director of Spaulding and chief of surgery.
Mm-hmm.
But then he was asked to provide the liaison with Emily Grady. And then the doors began to open. And just as a footnote, Grady Hospital now has, Asa told me this last year, he made some inquiry of all the big training hospitals across the country and other parts of where you would expect that this would not have occurred. And you know, Grady had the highest percentage of black graduate staff of any in the country. It's a very desirable training place, you see, which has been exclusive province.
I'm a little cynical about why all this happened. I'm sort of looking for the trade-off. What were whites looking for?
Well, you have to answer that. I don't think life is...
you would know better what happened in that.
Well, I don't think ever trade-offs are ever that clear. Mm-hmm. I mean, in terms of the mass population, or even in terms of the leadership, I think there may be some rare instances when it's more obvious. But I think it's generally people coming to understand that the total welfare is inextricably bound up together.
Did newspapers pick up the story at all?
They picked up positive. You know, it's a fine thing that this has come to pass.
But it was basically the reports that you were issuing.
Right.
It was basically the reports that you were issuing.
Well, it was based on shared information of the need that was now being met, I guess.
I guess there was, maybe there was a more enlightened white leadership here that was able to...
Well, I think there are always more, there are enlightened citizens who are glad of an opportunity, are glad to be asked to, to share something that isn't the total good.
In regard to the schools, what I've read so far is that when the black community got into schools like Washington High School, it was really as a result of threatening not to vote for certain bond school bond.
I don't remember that very well, but I remember the occasion because I was a little girl then.
Yeah, that was right.
But there had been just nothing done about black schools, and it was a very racist paper. I don't even remember the title of it. I remember hearing my parents talk about it in the community. Mm-hmm. And it was a boycott of the paper. Everybody was to drop the Atlanta, Georgia. And it was because, I guess it was because there was no willingness on the part of the school people to consider the Negroes. And the paper was picking up there. And there was a threat that the bond issue would be defeated. And that was not the 46 bond issue. That was earlier. But the, and that threat was evidently what turned the tide in this early effort to...
I guess that's what I was sort of thinking about what happened later on, you know. Mm-hmm. No concern among whites back then about black school system, and yet you get some concern in the 1940s about the hospital.
Well, a lot of things have happened since then.
Well, except for the ending of the white primary, really, what it happened.
Oh, there were a great many things that happened then.
Well, okay, in terms of race relations.
I think, in terms of race, that's in terms of human relations. As you get a broader, educated electorate,
mm-hmm.
and more ways to get intimate knowledge, or not intimate knowledge, but more knowledge than you had before, of the needs, then it begins to dawn on the political leaders that the welfare of the poor, even down to the dollar and cents level. You see, I mean, it's not simple, but that seems to me the process by which communities learn.
Was there any sense at all that segregation hurt white schools as much as it did black schools by...
I think this was a late development.
What, 1940s, 50s?
In the 40s.
I think they were spending money...
Leading up to the 54 school decisions.
So there was some sort of sense they were duplicating their efforts, that they were wasting money.
And they were wasting money. But I think that began to go on later on. And even then... it wasn't a telling argument.
Well,
the resistance to school integration.
Yes. I also read someplace that the Atlanta Board of Education built new schools, as you were going to, in all white and all black neighborhoods, and allowed schools in transitional areas to decline, thereby trying to help the whites in transitional areas to move out.
Well, I don't think there's any question about the fact that following the 54 decision, when the next rash of school buildings occurred, and this was not the 54 bond issue, I mean the 46 bond issue, but there was a rash of building in black neighborhoods, or neighborhoods that were in transition, and that's why we have a great many central city schools now, you know, underused. I wasn't on the Board of Education, but it was perfectly clear. There was this mad rush, new schools here, there, and yonder.
So why? What were they trying to do?
Well, I guess they were trying to prevent them from wishing to go to better facilities.
So that's true. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I thought was happening.
And to slow down the voluntary transfer program, because they agreed to it near week in the negotiations that followed the 54C. But I don't think much of the white leadership welcomed it. Now, that's not to say that there were none who did.
Well, it occurs to me that what they were really trying to do was keep the two groups as separate as possible.
That's right.
Even in the neighborhoods that were transitional neighborhoods, there seemed to be...
Well, that's reflected in the fact that now, when it seems to some of us more and more obvious that a more effective school system in Atlanta and Fulton County would be to have one school system, as it would be to have one Fulton Atlanta government, really.
Yes.
Less wasteful, less, and better for everybody. But when you get people even working on the, or really concerned about the working of, on a better relationship between the city and the county, so many of the people surprise me. People who, you know, say, oh, well, that's fine, but you know, the one thing that'll block it is people will object to merging the school systems. And what we have in Fulton County now is a North Fulton County system and a South Fulton County system and a lab in between. And the black system, the South system is getting more and more. There are more and more black students there. But the money to support an adequate system of education is not increasing that fast.
And then you have a lot of split of the money, right?
Well, that would, of course, there would be the usual negotiation on what you do with the money, but I personally think that that's going to be the force that makes people face reality sooner or later.
But basically, you think it's sort of a racial factor? That,
oh, I'm sure it's a racial factor.
That's keeping the school systems apart, but keeping us from getting regional government?
Well, I think it's a factor that slows down.
Yeah.
The consolidation of Atlanta Fulton. Now, I'm not thinking about a metro thing.
That's, well, even administration. Getting back to the politics a little bit, your election to the Georgia House in 66, I was curious of what was different in 66 that would allow a black person to be elected to the Georgia House?
Well, you see, Georgia faced a court action. They had had a prior court action which required the Senate to be reapportioned.
Mm-hmm.
And so there had been black senators, either one, there had been one.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 65, there was a court order requiring a reapportionment of the Georgia House.
Mm-hmm.
And Fulton County had five representatives up to that time. And the one-man vote decision came, see, and so the Fulton delegation jumped from five members to 28. And so all the community leadership was concerned about finding people who were warm, willing, and able, and who were thought to be good public service to offer for this great number of new House seats in predominantly black districts.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the district in which I was elected was, the lines have changed many times since then, but it was a central city district which included Georgia Tech.
Mm-hmm.
And not even very far west. And that year, I think there were either six or seven black representatives chosen from Atlanta. I think there's a there are about four people, white and black, in the delegation who were elected in that particular.
So because of the reapportionment, then you're saying?
It was because of the realignment of districts.
Yeah, and you were then able to be elected by a pretty much all black district?
No, it was not all black at that time.
Okay.
My district is predominantly black now.
Yeah.
But for the first two elections, I don't know what the proportion was, but I would think at least a third. In fact, the first two times I ran, I had white opposition. I had a white student from Tech the first time, and a white man the second time. I don't even remember who he was. But increasingly, the lines have been modified so that my district is now almost completely black. It's not completely.
Was there much of a racial factor to that? Or too early?
Not that I knew of. I mean,
I have to do that also. Okay, there was no...
I don't recall any racial factor in it.
Okay, did the whites help you?
At least, I guess they did. Okay. This guy that ran the first time, as I remember, did have a very small part of the vote.
So there was nothing changed by 66 where there was a feeling that whites could support a black leader.
Well, I don't know that it was that sophisticated. There was recognition that, I think there was more recognition then than there is now that there should be some evidence of community leadership in the people chosen to serve in the legislature. That's a generalization which I couldn't prove. but that's my general impression.
How about when you were already serving in the House, did you get, were you treated as just another...
Oh, that's the inevitable question. The first year I was over there, I was one of two women in the legislature, and of course the only black woman.
Right.
And one of a group of about six blacks, as I recall, six or seven in the House. And I was have always been treated graciously, and as I always say, I think the way you're treated depends upon the way you expect to be treated. And it was a year full of tension because that was this first year was the year the Julian Barnes seat was challenged.
Sure.
And it was a House trial with all those, I can remember the debate one. I can't remember who the lawyer was, but he was somebody who had once been in the House, and they brought him up to do the hearing that night, and they had the House trial, and he said, I look over this honorable body and place of, and he called off a lot of former members who were no longer. In place of that, I see the infamous Mr. Bond. You could read his mind and know the ways they probably felt like quitting it. But I think one of the good things that came from that reapportionment is that it's been clearer and clearer that people's basic nature, whether they're white or black, mm-hmm. and basic interests just come out. I mean, I think there's been great mutual education from both sides. But I've been very fortunate in the people I've worked with in the House, both speakers, people who were interested in my concerns and were at least willing to help as they could.
But there wasn't any kind of leftover racist bitterness against you at all?
Not overtly.
That's good. At least it wasn't overtly.
No, it was not. So far, in my experience, there's been no overt racial business.
I was also curious about the Urban League as a liaison between white and black leaders, which I apparently was. I was curious how much did white politicians, just being Clarksfield and Fell and so on, Allen, actually seek black advice on issues? Was there a sort of ongoing communication?
Well, I don't think it was limited to the League, but I think from Hartsfield's time back forward,
mm-hmm.
And I don't think it was in terms of the organization per se, but it was in terms of personalities, staff and board members that gave access, or that they had reason to know through one reason or another. So there was discussion. The only campaign I, of course, was interested in Mr. Hartsfield. Mr. Hartsfield's effort and interest primarily in increasing the participation, broadening the franchise. The first political campaign that I worked in as a volunteer actively was Adam Allen's first campaign. And
he faced the Maddox campaign.
I don't remember. Yes, he did.
But they sought your advice on.
Yeah.
How about another thing that was happening in the city during this time? For example, urban renewal. Was black advice sought on?
Well, the big effort that this was when I was at the League, and I don't know. I knew I was concerned, and the League staff was concerned. Was the Forward Atlanta campaign, which was the effort to broaden the boundaries, and we all did what we could as individuals. And the guy who, I think the staff man who did that main study was Phil Hammer, who was with the, he was with him before he formed his own consulting firm, but I can remember we were interested in sharing information and building support as best we could on that, on those communications. People who were primarily interested in it.
How about on the issue of the facing most federal housing projects on the west side? That seems to be
big concern?
Well, the big concern of the League in terms of housing, I guess you talked to Mr. Thompson about that.
Was
to disperse the housing. And our concern primarily, as I recall, the emphasis at the League at that time was to make available, we said make accessible to Negroes who wish to enjoy suburban living, tracts which could be developed for suburban living.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was the effort to open up the Northwest, and then later to open up the Southwest.
But the Northeast was never opened up. The Northeast?
Well, the Northeast at that time was a very heavy black population, the old Fourth Ward. There had been movement into the near end West Side that started, I guess, in the mid-30s. I know that there was an effort that Mr. Thompson and other people on the League's housing staff worked with the housing authority people in dispersing. I think many of us know that it was an error in planning. I don't know, it was not our error.
An error in terms of what?
An error in terms of creating too large concentrations of very low-income people.
Yeah.
And that's the big Perry Homes was the first one, and the Archer Homes was the next great big one. Of course, they were faced with the problem of the great displacement that occurred when they built the stadium, when they built the big turnaround of 75-20 and so on and so on. And therefore, a great need. But, you know, this is hindsight, but it was...
Do you think that building of the stadium and where they put the highway was an effort to get blacks out of the...
Oh, I don't think so. I think it was all the economic considerations, I think, were practical. The people that were most directly affected and in terms of their residences being just destroyed, mm-hmm. and they're having to relocate, were black citizens in one of the oldest neighborhoods of the city.
Because I've read things about the stadium and the Civic Center being built as buffers as ways of moving the black community out of the downtown, pushing them westward, pushing them southward.
Well, maybe that happens. And of course, where the Civic Center was built was really one of the worst slum areas of Atlanta, bottom. That was one of the oldest slum areas, and the people that were displaced there went, I guess, first to the near end public housing project. That was even before the Civic Center.
Do you ever come across any highways being built as buffers, as a way of splitting the two communities up in the west side here?
Well, there's a famous place of Peyton Road.
Yeah.
You know about Peyton Road.
I've heard about his barricade.
Mr. Hartfield said, never make a mistake that they can take a picture of.
I spoke to...
And I haven't learned very fast about that. He came down fast. It was his error. Okay. It was an effort to reduce expansion, I guess, into the southwest, which was solid and white then.
Yeah, I spoke to Mayor Allen about that. He still apologizes about that.
Well, give him credit, he learned fast.
Well, I guess he did.
He did learn fast.
Okay, I also just sort of to wind it up. Again, I've read a lot about a tradition of and spirit of compromise and communication in Atlanta between blacks and whites, and supposedly that helped avoid any kind of violence in the city. Do you think there was a real sense, not so much of a city too busy to hate, but a city where there was an effort being made to open up channels of communication?
I'm sure that's true. I don't know that it was the slogan, a city too busy to hate, was a PR line.
Oh, yeah.
Line.
Not very true.
But without the willingness of some of the political leadership in the top levels,
mm-hmm.
to seek out ways. And that was certainly true of Hartsfield in those later days, and of Allen,
yeah.
and of others that have followed. I don't think there's any question that Atlanta has had that going for it.
Mm-hmm.
And have been fortunate in the quality leadership that could see that the well-being of the total community depended on working together and seeking to increase the ways in which there could be joint consideration of what it was wise to do.
So the lines of communication were kept up, at least beginning in Huntsville.
Yes, they began then, and I think they've been strengthened ever since.
Yeah, I'm not sure how far back it goes beyond that.
I can't speak to that, I don't know.
Do you think that spirit of compromise at all helped Atlanta become the civil rights center? In fact, that most of the organizations located here.
Well, I guess because Atlanta was the great city of the South, that was one of the reasons. I mean, both white and black, you know, it was because the efforts the so-called revolution of the 60s,
mm-hmm.
it started in Alabama.
Yeah.
They moved the headquarters to Atlanta, you know, and I guess that was because there were the other, it was a center of organization as well as community leadership.
Well, I guess in terms of them not keeping the organization in Montgomery, for example.
Was the reason for that.
The reason for that being that Atlanta, I guess, is a place where there was at least some experience in dealing with black leadership.
Well, because there was, I would say, a larger group of developed leadership. You see, Atlanta was larger even then than Montgomery.
Because you had the black college.
Right. And you did have the residue. And I think the presence of these black institutions of higher education has been a great influence.
Yeah, I hear that from
over the years. I mean, when you begin to look at people, that was...
Let me just turn this over.
So, what I heard from one of the other people was that that they were black leadership in Atlanta were people who were educated, well off, and therefore they had...
Not necessarily well off.
Well,
they say they were poor, but they didn't feel poor.
Okay, at least middle class, certainly.
I never know what's meant by that, but...
But in that sense, they had more of a...
They were informed and educated, an educated base.
And therefore had more ties with the black leaders, with the white leaders, I suppose.
Well, maybe so, maybe no. But as you look over the state, as the emergence of, as little as I know about the individual leadership in the rural parts of the state, much of it came from people who used basic college education. They went into these counties as school teachers, as principals, and so on, so on. But that became the nucleus of political development, mm-hmm. citizenship education.
How about the non-violent tradition of the violence, the fact that things were worked out whenever possible through behind the scenes, compromise and whatnot? Do you think this influenced King Jr. at all in terms of his non-violent approach? I don't know how well you knew him at all.
I knew him very well, but I wouldn't presume how anybody gets there.
Yeah. And everybody was speaking of the Gandhi...
And he said that he was influenced mostly by the Gandhi influence.
Which I'm sure he was. I was just curious how much he was influenced by growing up in Atlanta, which was a
city. Well, I'll tell you a story that somebody told me about. King's first pastorate was in a Baptist church in Montgomery.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the community leadership in Montgomery was the one, I forgot what they called it, the Montgomery Improvement Association, I think. But they were the group that rallied behind Mrs. Parks.
Mm-hmm.
And this person who was a leader, and the head of the group, and I remember so well, he was telling me this story when I was at the league. He came and he said, you know, we had a meeting, and we said, now we've got to get a figure who speaks well, and who can unify the people. King had just come to that church and said, but he evidently had the gift of gab. I mean, he talked well. He was just good. And so he was chosen to be the leader first of this Montgomery voters league or whatever they called it. Improvement Society, I think. And then the Southern Christian Leadership thing came later, and it came over here.
But there's no sense of any kind of being influenced by where he grew up.
Well, you know, you can't separate. He, again, he grew up under the influence of the black colleges.
Mm-hmm.
He went to Morehouse.
Mm-hmm.
And he grew up in a community where there was, quote, intelligent black leadership.
And apparently some intelligent white leadership.
And some intelligent white leadership. So it was a part of his heritage, like.
I was just curious, had he grown up in Birmingham or Little Rock, whether this would have been, whether he would have been less influenced by a nonviolent approach to issues.
I don't know.
Yeah, well, there's no way of finding out, of course. Especially, I can't even, his father's gone now, so he would be the one that would probably be most knowledgeable about that. I was also curious, just as a final point, the end of the Alliance of Negro Voters League, what happened to it? Why did it put up?
I don't really know what happened to it. I think that, you mean as a nonpartisan deliberative body? I guess as there was greater access to the Democratic Party and greater response to the by the National Democratic Party to the basic civil rights needs of black citizens, there was, I don't even know what the, and as the Democratic Party itself opened up its ranks to black people, and I'm talking just about Gladys Ford County, because I don't know, I've never been, you know, an active participant in the state group business, that had something to do with it.
What the Atlanta Fulton County Democrat Organization didn't open up to blacks yet until the mid-60s, in terms of letting blacks on their board. I
can't remember the dates, but it must have been
early
60s.
Well, then if they closed, I think they were the first to, one of the first to get
I think it'd be on the county executive committee.
Was there any reason why it took them so long? I mean, black political power has been building up for some time now. Why did they first wake up at that particular time?
Well, the black leadership was using the tools available to them.
Mm-hmm.
And when there was more response in terms of the structure. I can't remember when it was that they instituted, when they redid the Fulton County Democratic Party's bylaws and elected the executive committee. I don't remember when that was, even though I was on it for 2 or 3 years.
Well, I think it was the mid-60s.
I would guess that's right. Yeah. You know Baker's book.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Sorry, I didn't get a chance to speak to him too, of course.
Yes, he was a great
man. I met him in
great
back in 75, I think, but that was before I was getting into his research.
What is your interest? Political science or history?
It's history.
History.
So I'm just trying to do a study of race relations in the 20th century, and of course I'm trying to interview people who were knowledgeable about that in that period. I've spoken to, let's see, Robert Thompson, Reverend Borders, John Calhoun, and folks the rest of the world. Warren Cochrane will speak to next month when he gets back from New York. And when the whites, Michelle and Alan and Cecil Alexander, I spoke to.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So I'm moving along. Trying to contact various people.
Trying to think of this. I guess you've got the main answer then. You know that. Active political.
Yeah. Well, Jake Henderson, I think.
And Jake Henderson was a member. He was one of the. He was on my board at that time and was very active in the operation. And I think at that time he was also president of one of the Greek Letter fraternities, if I'm not mistaken. But he was a real factor in that all citizens registration
effort. There's a whole list of people I still want to get in touch with.
Mm-hmm.
That should be good.
When's your thesis of book ending?